I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. If you don't have health insurance, you have until February 15th to sign up through the healthcare.gov website. So far, about 7 million people have signed up since the Affordable Care Act went into effect, making the administration's goal of 9.1 million insured by the end of the year very doable. Meanwhile, the new Congress, now controlled by Republicans, want to make some changes in the Affordable Care Act. We asked Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, to tell us how the health care law is performing, and she joins us from the studios of NPR. Mary Agnes Carey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So is this second rollout much smoother than the first?
It is much smoother. You might remember from a year ago all the website crashes and problems and so on that were really dogging the enrollment and causing a lot of problems for the administration. Generally, things are working more smoothly. There are still, of course, some problems as people get closer to deadlines. For example, if you wanted health insurance to start January 1st, you had to enroll by December the 15th. If you look at the marketplace traffic leading up to that deadline, lots more people calling. Some people simply left their name and had the marketplace call them back. So leading up to deadlines, you're going to have a problem. And there continues to be, for example, some of that communication, the back end with the insurers, who's changed plans, who may or may not have paid their premium, and so on. You're still going to have some of those mechanics. They call that the back end of the website. That's still there, but by and large, all those crashes we saw last year are not happening on anywhere near the same scale as they did a year ago.
I said about 7 million people or so who have signed up. Is that correct?
Yeah. If you look at the federal government operates the exchanges in the vast majority, like 37 states. And so there you have about 6.6 million folks who've signed up. The state numbers are a little more unreliable, but for the 14 states, and that also includes the District of Columbia in that number, they've got the rest of that around 650,000 people or so that have signed up so far. And as you noted, the enrollment period ends February 15th. Mm. So the thought is, as they get closer, we're about a month or so out, that the administration will comfortably hit that deadline of rather projection of 9.1 million people who have not only picked a plan but are paying their premiums.
When you look at who is signing up, I don't know if there's a profile or not. And I know early on the government wanted these young invincibles, you know, these young,
right,
healthy
exactly.
people to sign up. Mary Agnes, is there any way to know whether they are part of the millions of people who are signing up?
They are part of the millions of people who are signing up. They're, I want to say, a fairly healthy share, pardon the pun, of the new enrollees. And then also, if you look across the demographic, more people in different age groups are signing up. I mean, there's more awareness of the health law. There's more interest in it. Some groups continue to be difficult to enroll. Latinos is an area where the administration is continuing to work to enroll those folks. They may have they have a variety of issues that may be stopping them, computer access, for example, or concerns that maybe if you're in a mixed status family, someone who is not documented somehow could be jeopardized by you enrolling. The administration's gone out of their way to say that won't be the case. But nonetheless, it is interesting to look at the enrollment numbers and see, you know, what a difference a year makes.
And how many people are getting government subsidies to help pay for their insurance?
That is a really large number. It's something like 80-85% of those who are enrolled. And typically, the subsidy is linked to the second lowest cost silver plan. The insurance is given out platinum, gold, silver, and bronze, right? So they look at the lowest cost silver plan, and that's where they hook the subsidy. And so that's where you see a fairly large number, significantly large number of folks that enroll in those silver plans, because that's where they can get these tax credits that help them afford the premiums. And in some cases, depending on your income, you can even get help with your co-pays and deductibles.
Really? Wow. I mean, does that tell us that we have a lot of poor people in this country, or this has a very sort of generous description of low income?
Probably depends on who you talk to. I mean, health insurance is expensive. And even with the Affordable Care Act and the creation of the exchanges, this affordability question comes back over and over. And so depending on where you fall on the income scale, the subsidies are from 100 to 400% of poverty, unless you're in one of those states that expanded Medicaid. And then if you're up to 138% of poverty, you're getting the Medicaid coverage. But for folks that are enrolling in insurance, the more money you make, right, the less generous that subsidy is going to be. So that can be sort of a struggle for some folks. But the subsidies definitely help people enroll in insurance. But you mentioned Republicans earlier. I mean, one of the things they might be looking at is that subsidy level. I've had a lot of Republicans tell me they understand they want folks at the lower end of the economic scale to get help. But do you have to have subsidies as generous as what are in the Affordable Care Act?
Well, interesting. And let's talk a little bit about what the government, now both houses controlled by Republicans, one is to look at this 30-hour rule. How does it stand today, and what do the Republicans or what do the members of Congress, because some Democrats want to do this as well, what are some of the changes that are being discussed?
Well, as you mentioned, the House of Representatives just last week passed a law that would change this requirement in the Affordable Care Act to define full-time work at 40 hours rather than what's in the law, which is 30 hours. And the ironic thing about that is when you make a change in a law, you affect how much it costs. And increasing the full-time work requirement to 40 hours would actually add to the deficit, because you would have more people getting subsidies. You have fewer employers paying this fee if they have 50 or more workers and they don't provide insurance for their employees. And also you would have more people become uninsured, and you would have more folks in Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. So that's one of those items there. As you mentioned, some Democrats are for it. A dozen Democrats voted for it in the House. There are some in the Senate that want this to move forward. But the Republicans in the Senate need to get 60 votes to move this forward. So they definitely need some Democratic support. It's unclear yet whether or not they're going to get that. But the Republicans are talking now about having something ready when the Supreme Court would rule on this subsidy issue in June. And again, that's the debate about whether the subsidies are intended for just the state-run exchanges or all of the exchanges, whether the state government, the federal government runs it. So what's going to be in that alternative, we don't know yet. But I think it's pretty clear when you look at some of the things Republicans have talked about. They don't like the employer mandate. They don't like the individual mandate. Obviously, we've talked about the 30 to 40-hour work requirement. They may adjust the subsidy level. And they're going to take their time doing this, because I think when you look at you just mentioned how both chambers are controlled by Republicans. They've gone since the creation of the ACA without a unified alternative, and they've done very well politically, simply coming out criticizing the law and voting for either its entire repeal or partial repeal. So they've made it clear they're trying to they're going to take their time and find what works to see if they can get consensus on an alternative. And to be frank, some don't even want to offer an alternative.
I hear you. And I should say to our listeners, we'll be talking about this case that will be argued before the Supreme Court, King v. Burwell, getting sort of deep into what that is all about. But in the meantime, talking with Mary Agnes Carey. She's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she's one of the people, one of the few people in this country that actually understands our health care system, the Affordable Care Act. We've been talking about folks signing up, and there are many moving parts in this act as well. And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Mary Agnes, I remember before the Affordable Care Act went into effect, there were concerns that companies would be dumping their health care coverage, or essentially saying to their employees, you can get your health insurance through these websites. We're not going to cover you anymore. Has that happened?
There is not, from the analysts that study this and the government agencies that track it, there is no data to show that's happening on a widespread widespread across the country. But that said, you've probably heard this from your listeners. I hear it from people that I interview and talk to every day, or if I do a radio or a television show, that there are people who are saying their employers are simply they're not going to add more people, right? Because they don't want to offer health insurance. Or some employers are saying they don't want to offer insurance because it's too expensive. They're withdrawing. I think there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, but we don't seem to have this yet on a wide scale, if it would happen at all. But one thing that I have to constantly remind myself in watching this law is the really big provisions just started January of 2014. That's the marketplaces we've been talking about, the Medicaid expansion, the subsidies to get coverage. And this is its effect on the price of insurance, the number of people enrolled, on companies, and so on. The cost, it's all going to play out over years to come.
Mm. I remember over Thanksgiving having family members complaining bitterly about the cost of their health care, the higher deductibles, the co-pays that they have to have. I mean, part of this, and as you said, Mary Agnes, this is in process, but has there been the kind of cost containment that the Obama administration and others said would happen, or is it just too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell, and there will be people who have told me that their employer has told them that their health insurance is more expensive because of the health care law. And that could be because perhaps there was a plan that was offered to these folks previously that is no longer compliant with the Affordable Care Act. And maybe that's why their insurance has gone up. Maybe there are new benefits. It's more comprehensive and so on. But it's really too soon to say whether it has cost containment specifically because of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, health care costs are still rising. They're rising at a slower rate. But it could be a variety of factors, including the Affordable Care Act.
There was an article, I think it was in the New York Times, about professors at Harvard University balking at higher costs. And I guess the article got some attention because there were folks from Harvard who were part of putting together the Affordable Care Act. But is this just kind of the fact of life of what we live in?
Yeah, the first thing I thought was, well, welcome to the club when I read
yeah,
it.
I was going to say, yeah. That was pretty generous benefits that they were getting.
This trend of an employer shifting more of the cost to the worker, whether it's through a higher premium or more out-of-pocket costs, is nothing new. And that is one very, very common thing that employers use to help reduce their cost of providing health insurance for their workers.
And again, talking with Mary Agnes Carey about the Affordable Care Act, and we will be taking a break in just a minute. But again, the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. As you said, healthcare costs have increased, but not as much as they were in the past. So flesh that out for us, if you could, Mary Agnes.
Well, health insurance is expensive to provide, and we all like the newest tests, the latest drug. If your doctor tells you there's a certain amount of tests that you need to have performed, you want that done. But there are counter pressures in the system to try to help keep those costs down. I mean, one thing you can look at in the Affordable Care Act, for example, is in Medicare, they are now looking at hospitals, the Medicare program, and saying, if you have patients that you've discharged and they're returned in a certain time to the hospital with one of five conditions, we're going to dock your payment for that, for example. Hospital-acquired infections, right? Nobody wants to think about this, but you could say sometimes one of the worst places for you to be when you're sick is in the hospital because there's so many germs there and you can get sick so easily. These hospital-acquired infections, that's another area through the ACA where Medicare is cracking down on payment.
And I do want to pick up on that a quick break beforehand. Again, that's Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Taking a very short break, I see calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. In about 10 minutes or so, I'll be talking with Ted Ruger about a case that's going to be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, King v. Burwell, and it challenges a part of the Affordable Care Act. In the meantime, Mary Agnes Carey staying with us for the rest of the portion of this Radio Times from Kaiser Health News. She's giving us an update on who is signing up for the Affordable Care Act, getting insurance through the Affordable Care Act, and a bit about some of the costs and care and coverage. And it looks like we have an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Mary Agnes, you were talking about hospital care. I was looking at some pie charts, and hospital care still is a pretty sizable portion of what we pay out when it comes to health care costs.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It's a big portion of the cost, and that's why Medicare, for example, which is insuring, you know, millions of seniors and disabled folks, is looking at the Medicare policy for payment as a way to shape what not only the federal government pays, but also that what the private sector looks at what Medicare pays and follows.
Also looking at things that have gone up, prescription drugs being one, the other being Medicaid itself. Is that because more people have been signing up for Medicaid?
More people have been signing up for Medicaid. And for example, with the Affordable Care Act expansion, which it would expand Medicaid coverage to folks who make about $16,000 a year. As of the end of October, you had about 9.7 million people enroll in Medicaid. So Medicaid is definitely growing. But one thing on drugs that you mentioned.
Yes.
Another thing to look that's kind of monitoring some of that growth is the growth in the use of generics. As drugs go off patent, generic market share increases. Those are lower costs, not only for your insurer, your employer, but for us as individuals, as patients, we pay less for those. Those are working to try to keep some, balance there in the prescription drug costs.
We have an email from Judy O. She says, my daughter lives in Louisiana, will be losing her coverage under our policy as she is turning 26. Where can she go to get help in figuring out her options? She is currently unemployed, and the application asks for income to determine subsidies. Very important question, Mary Agnes.
Right. Well, what I would do is if your daughter's done this, I would go to healthcare.gov. And that's going to ask a variety of prompts. That state has the federal government is in Louisiana running that exchange. So that's the first thing I would do. Follow those prompts. See if you can get answers. If she is confused, healthcare.gov has an 800 number, and you can get it very easily on the website. Call that 800 number. If you need further help on the website, you can, by your zip code, they'll tell you in-person assistance you can get in your area. These are people who've been trained, understand the healthcare law, and take you through the process. But I would advise her to get on this as soon as possible because she's going to want that coverage to start as soon as she's off her parents' plan.
And there are, I guess, people that don't sign up. They're going to pay for this, in a sense, through their tax forms. Can you flesh that out for us?
Sure. If you didn't have healthcare coverage in the current, for 2014, you will pay the greater of $95 or 2% of income, whichever is greater. And what happens is when you file your taxes, for the people who have health insurance, they'll simply check the box that said they're covered. If you don't check that box and you're not covered and you don't qualify for an exemption, then you're going to have to pay this fine. It will be taken out of your tax return. So it's one of those things that as the years go on, 2015, it's more money. The fine is greater. Same thing for 2016. They're trying to push folks through this penalty. This is the part of the individual mandate, the requirement that people get insurance unless they qualify for an exemption.
Let me see what George from Worcester, Pennsylvania has to say. George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm concerned that we're kind of missing the greater point, which is we're not necessarily getting access to quality health care once we get signed up for this. I've had Affordable Care Act insurance now last year and this year, and we're also being misled by the insurance companies. They're doing everything they can to kind of create these difficult-to-understand plans. The healthcare.gov website wasn't clear this year in terms of what I would actually have to pay for coinsurance and deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums and that sort of thing. And I know I don't have much time here, but I just think it's a shame that we can't go to single payer and go back to treating people with quality care rather than the experience I've had over the last couple of visits to my physician where everything is electronic medical record satisfaction and not really looking me in the eyes and asking me how I'm doing and what really the problem is.
Well, George, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm sorry you're having trouble. I don't know, Mary Agnes, if there was the good old days of healthcare where everyone, had the perfect doctor and nurse to take care of them.
I think George raises a lot of excellent points. Yep. Number one is the quality. Does access equal quality? In his case, it sounds like he's dissatisfied. I would personally advise him to get another doctor. Lots of doctors can manage their electronic health care record requirements and look you in the eye and ask you how you're doing. So that's my very first thought. But this is there are a lot of things in creating a law as large as the Affordable Care Act to be considered, right? How many people can you get covered? And then you start looking at the kind of coverage they're getting, the quality of the coverage that's delivering. And for example, his question about how much his copays and deductibles are, if he doesn't understand it through healthcare.gov, he's buying that through a private company. This takes time, and some people feel uncomfortable with it, but I advise people get on the phone. And you can, once you type in your ID number like six times, you're going to get a real person on that phone to say, I don't understand. Why didn't you cover this? What is my out-of-pocket cost? Why isn't this particular cost in my deductible or whatever your question is? You have to demand your health care even once you're covered. And for some people, this is an onerous task, but it's really important.
But, I mean, we have, I don't know if the system is any more or less complicated than it was, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But nonetheless, we're all dealing with a very complicated system.
Absolutely.
And that's just, I mean, we're not going to have single payer. Is that what you're telling us?
No, Mary, I mean, it's, yeah, this was a big conversation, right, when the Affordable Care Act was created. Why don't we have it? People still talk about it. There's no indication we're going anywhere near there. But that doesn't mean the people that advocate single payer don't still feel very passionate about it and want to see that in our country. I mean, who knows what the future will be?
We did shows about single payer, Medicare for all. I mean, there's so many different ways to look at this. One more question for you, Mary Agnes. Is there enough now medical staff? If more people are signing up for care and coverage, are there enough people to provide that care and coverage?
That's a great great question. My colleague Julie Robner at Kaiser Health News did a great piece a few weeks ago about how questioning this idea that there is a doctor shortage with all the new people that are insured. But one of the bigger things to watch there, I think, is what states allow a nurse practitioner to do. For example, do you allow various nurses and other professionals to practice to the full extent of their license? This is kind of a state-by-state fight because different states, especially rural areas, you may not have enough physicians to go around. So do you allow your nurse practitioners, your nurse anesthetists, and so on to do more care perhaps than they might have before, or extend their license ability to do more of this kind of thing? So this is something to watch as more and more people become insured, especially in our rural states. Do we have enough providers out there?
I noticed drugstores are now providing some care.
Right, exactly. I mean, we've got a minute clinic near our house where if my child has a sore throat it's Sunday morning at 8 o'clock, if it's open, I'll go there. Urgent care centers are the same thing. There are a lot of people out there getting in the game of trying to provide health care to people. But again, I live in Washington, D.C. I live in an urban area. I've got lots of access. That's not the same everywhere in the country.
And are people doing that rather than going to the emergency room? I know that was another problem that the Affordable Care Act was trying to fix.
Right. They could. People, I think it depends. If you look at, for example, my copay for the ER has increased, that's a disincentive for people to go to the ER if they have a sore throat. They might want to go to their urgent clinics. And a lot of the urgent care clinics now have expanded to take more health insurance. So that's an incentive for you to go there. And as a consumer, you're going to make the judgments. If you go to an ER on a Saturday night in an urban area, are you stuck with the gunshot victims while you're waiting for your child's sore throat to be looked at? Would you prefer to go to an urgent care center that may be a little further away than the ER? But if they take your health insurance, you'll like it. I mean, there are a lot of dynamics changing in healthcare, even beyond the Affordable Care Act.
I was going to say goodbye to you, but I see a Facebook comment from Tom. I just want to read this, and then I'll have to say goodbye to you, Mary Agnes Carey. Tom says, my Blue Cross insurance doubled in less than 2 years. More people in the insurance marketplace should equal lower insurance rates. Please have your guest address what can be done with the insurance companies gouging all of us. Is that what is actually going on, Mary Agnes?
Here's what I don't know about that plan. If he had a plan that wasn't compliant with the Affordable Care Act, and it was – did he say it was dropped or it just went up in price?
It went up in price, doubled,
in price.
Says.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that is interesting. When you look across the country, the average increases in the lowest cost silver plan is about 5%, right? And for the bronze plan, I think it's around the same amount of money. So It kind of depends what you're buying and where you're buying it. It's weird. It's a patchwork, and you can have price differences even within a state, between counties. So it's a lot of where it's offered, how many insurers got in the game, and what do they think from their first year of experience in the Affordable Care Act? Do they say, well, we need to increase our prices? I mean, there's a variety of factors that could affect what he's paying.
Well, Mary Agnes Carey, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And I see both from email comments and tweets and also phone calls. So we could have gone on for another hour or so. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That's Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she joined us from the studios of NPR. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear a challenge to the Affordable Care Act when it hears a case in March, King v. Burwell. The plaintiffs argue that the subsidies that consumers get through the federal health exchange aren't legal. And if a majority of the court agrees, it could be a blow to the Affordable Care Act. And joining us now is Ted Ruger, and he's Deputy Dean Professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He teaches and writes in the fields of constitutional law, health law, and statutory interpretation. And Ted Ruger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
Flesh out for us this King v. Burwell case. I gave a tiny little description there.
Sure. Well, this is a major challenge to the Act, and it's somewhat complicated how it fits with the structure of the Act, so just to take it step by step. As you mentioned, this is a challenge to the federal government's ability to help people out with subsidies in states that chose to let the federal government run their exchanges. So
the healthcare.gov.
That's right. So as you know, and your readers probably know, there were two major efforts to expand access to healthcare through this statute. The first is not at issue here. That's the Medicaid expansion that some states have been choosing. The other way for individuals who make between $20,000 and $100,000 a year and are struggling to get insurance through their jobs is this creation of these new entities called health insurance exchanges, where private companies, as your caller George mentioned, even these ACA insurance policies are offered by private insurers. And as such, given the high cost of healthcare, if they're priced accurately, are pretty expensive. And that's right. Probably out of the reach of somebody who makes with a family of four, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, it might cost as much as $8,000. So what the Act does is offers a sliding scale of subsidies. So you're going to get a lot of help if you make $30,000, a little bit of help if you make with a family of four, $70,000 or $80,000. But the goal is to make sure everybody can afford insurance. Now, the issue in this case arises because states under the Act were given a choice. Set up your own agency to set up your exchange, or choose to let the feds run it for you. And surprising to many of us, the vast majority of states either couldn't do it or didn't want to do it. And so 37 states now have said to the feds, you do it for us. So now this creates the issue because there's a tiny little clause in this very long statute that says that the tax subsidies are only available to in exchanges that are, quote, established by right. the state. And it's that tiny little phrase that this big case hinges on.
Through an exchange established by the state. And that's what's written into the Affordable Care Act.
That is one phrase that's written in the Affordable Care Act. Of course, it's a long statute. And other parts of the statute, I think, support the government's contention that exchange means any kind of exchange. But certainly what the challengers have latched onto is these little words, established by the state.
And who is King? And the King is the person challenging this the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act.
King is somebody who this is a impact litigation driven by the same folks that brought the case 2 years ago. But they found a plaintiff in King who's somebody who there's a part of the statute that says your the individual mandate applies to you if you can afford health insurance. And the plaintiff here could only afford it with the subsidies. So therefore, they're claiming that the mandate doesn't apply to them if this case goes forward.
Is there any legal standing for what Congress intended or what perhaps even the White House intended in writing the Affordable Care Act?
Well, that's the multi-million dollar question in this case. And indeed, this becomes a very contested case of statutory interpretation because you've got one phrase which taken on its own does suggest that only the state exchanges qualify for the subsidies. But when we look at the broader intent, which is a way of interpreting statutes that has a long pedigree, there's no evidence that Congress wanted to have this binary system. In a sense, there's no evidence that a ruling for King here would really punish people in the 37 states that chose to have the feds run their exchange. And there was no debate about that.
Do you think – I mean, it's getting into the minds of members of Congress and even the White House, but do you think people were surprised that so many states did not want to set up their own exchange and sort of tossed it back to the federal government, Fed.gov, to take care of it?
I think they were surprised, and those of us who observed the Axe development over the last 5 years were surprised. I mean, there is a built-in federalism dynamic here where states were offered the chance to craft their exchange – either consistent with more relatively free market values, relatively regulatory values. By kicking it back to the federal government, they adopt this one-size-fits-all exchange. So we thought that there would be more variation among states in choosing to tinker with their exchanges.
And why not just send it back to Congress and just say, you know, fix it. Rewrite this and get this sentence changed.
Well, I think – and your prior guest already addressed this. Today's Congress is not going to fix this, and the political will to change this little – it would just be a stroke of the pen, could fix this whole case.
Just draw a line through it, right?
In today's politics, the Republicans won't participate in that.
But do you think – I mean, if they were to do that, would that then open up all the language of the Affordable Care Act or – I mean, you're saying, you know, they wouldn't do it anyway. But
well, to be sure, if they revisited that clause, they might look at other clauses. But I should say the government and the supporters of the subsidies in throughout the country have good arguments even in the statute today.
Right.
There are other parts of the statute that read to say exchanges mean a federal or a state exchange. So this is the challenge for the justices, is not just to look at text versus intent, but to look at this fragment of text, but then also look at the longer statute, which does have other provisions which say that exchange means federal or state.
This is an important case, or an important challenge, I guess, of the Affordable Care Act, yes?
Oh, it's very important. It's a ruling in favor of King here and against the subsidies would potentially strip health insurance from up to 4 or 5 million people by taking away the subsidies. This would affect people immediately in Pennsylvania and the 36 other states where the feds are running it. So this is a big high-stakes case.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Ted Ruger about a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. This is a case that will be argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, King v. Burwell. We're getting a kind of a sneak preview about some of the issues at stake. And again, Ted Ruger, Deputy Dean Professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Any questions or comments? And it's kind of complicated law, but it's very important. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, talking with Ted Ruger. He's Deputy Dean Professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. In fact, an authority in the fields of constitutional law, health law, and statutory interpretation. Not exactly sure what that means, but we are talking about a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Again, a case that will be argued this year, probably in a couple of months, before the U.S. Supreme Court. A very important case, a King v. Burwell. The plaintiffs arguing that the subsidies that consumers get through the federal health exchange are not legal. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. A couple of tweets as well. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Ted, this is obviously a court doesn't get to the Supreme Court unless it's making its way through the lower courts. What have been the rulings or what's been the trajectory here?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting about this case, the Supreme Court only hears less than 1% of the cases where people seek review. So the court's very choosy, and it usually waits to see what these major lower federal courts, the courts of appeals, do. What's striking about this case is there was not a single lower federal court of appeals that ruled against the subsidies, that adopted the King argument, and it was bubbling up through multiple circuits. It was still at issue in the D.C. Circuit, which was about to hear it in an en banc hearing. In the Fourth Circuit, where King came from, the government won that case. And yet the Supreme Court still granted cert. So many of us who watch the court are surprised by how early the court grabbed this. This means it will be on the docket this spring.
Right.
And a decision will be rendered by the end of June. And if you want to make an inference, it seems that it takes 4 of the 9 justices' votes to grant certiorari. We can assume that at least 4 really wanted to take this case, and I would assume it's the 4 who voted against the Affordable Care Act the last time around. Kennedy, Scalia, Thomas and Alito. Now, the huge question, of course, is whether they think they can get that fifth vote in Chief Justice Roberts this time to really do damage to the act.
But Chief Justice John Roberts surprised a lot of people on the first go-around when he voted in favor of the Affordable Care Act.
He did. Well, he did change the act's Medicaid provisions, but
yes.
On the key issue of the individual mandate, he found a little-known power called the taxing power to sort of save that part of the statute. And so, again, this is a case where everybody's going to be speculating about the Chief Justice.
Why do you think they took it? I mean, is it just that the Affordable Care Act or the mandate is just has even among members of the U.S. Supreme Court has some political implications? Can we say that?
I think at the very least, whether we say political or not, I think that at least four justices have profound philosophical disagreement with this. As Justice Kennedy said in oral argument the first time around in 2012, he thinks this is a statute that fundamentally changes the relationship of the individual to the federal government. And so what's interesting is that case about the Commerce Clause and the power of the federal government really was about that big issue. Here we have a case which is about a tiny part of the statute which doesn't correspond to a big theoretical debate, but it's in my view, serving as a proxy to relitigate these major philosophical debates about the role of the federal government in healthcare. And as such, it's kind of an uneasy fit and perhaps even an inappropriate case to address those issues.
So if the court rules in favor of King, then what happens?
Well, so it creates an immediate shock to the system in the 37 states that have the federally run exchanges and affects the lives of upwards of 5-6 million people.
Now, that would include Pennsylvania, we should say,
to our listeners. That's right. Now, however, because this is a statutory case, not constitutional, if a state can change its own laws to comply with this interpretation of the phrase established by a state, then it gets the subsidies. And I think the workaround, so to speak, in a state like Pennsylvania would be they've got to do something, but with a governor and legislature who wants to cooperate and play ball – they could adopt, you know, an agency called the Exchange Board, and then the first day that board is convened, ink a subcontracting deal where they say we're going to let the feds run it for us. That I'm confident would qualify as established by the state. But if a state is politically riven and does nothing, their citizens are going to lose the subsidies.
Wow. I mean, broadly speaking, the states that did not want to set up the subsidies tended to be Southern. They tended to be more conservative. Mm-hmm. This subsidy is deemed illegal, those people that sign up, they're going to be hurt.
Yeah.
They're going to lose their subsidies.
That's right. And it'll be very interesting politically because here we've got red state governors throughout the country, but off predominantly, as you say, in the South and red states who this is not like the Medicaid expansion where only the poorest of the poor feel the brunt of it and maybe the politically powerless. This is affecting small business owners, small business workers, middle income folks in those red states, and it's going to force a very difficult political choice for Republican governors. Do they do whatever it takes to oppose Obamacare, or do they and thereby deprive their citizens of federal tax dollars, or do they realize that it's in their interest and their citizens' interest to actually work with the statute in this case?
And what we learned from Mary Agnes Carey is something like 80-some% of people signing up for health insurance just overall through either state or the federal government get some kind of subsidy. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a very subsidized group of people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, many people depend on these. Now, some of those are getting a small amount, and they could probably swing it. But a lot of them depend on the subsidies for their health insurance.
A tweet from Essie. What will it mean for those of us who found our plans via Marketplace if subsidies are found unconstitutional? It sounds like you're saying depends where you live.
Well, and it depends how much you make. So, you know, to be clear, there are people who if you can afford a Marketplace plan without the subsidies, your care in the short term won't be affected. Now, what we don't know is whether the insurance dynamics, if we drive people out of the Marketplace because there's no subsidies, do we have this risk spiral? So there could be a downstream even for somebody who's paying the full freight for their market-based exchange policy because there'll be fewer people in the pool and thereby maybe costs will go up.
A tweet from Nate seems like a gotcha attempt by conservatives. Will the court really allow what is essentially a typo to change the law? it's not exactly a typo, but it's, you know, it does seem to contradict some of the other parts of the law.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a typo, but I would say it's one fragment of text in a statute that has lots of other text that points in the direction of allowing the subsidies. And so, you know, you asked when you introduced me, what does statutory interpretation mean? Well, this is what it means: is you take a confusing statute, as many federal statutes are. You take text that points in different direction. You try to ascertain the purpose. You try to see, you know, what the fit with the words is, and it's a difficult task, and is sometimes inflected by pre-existing attitudes that the judges have. So that's why this case is uncertain, and why I could really see it going either way.
And could we say that, you know, most laws, most acts, most bills have contradictory language? They're not, you know, they're not written perfectly.
Absolutely. I mean, these are not nice, elegant pieces of poetry written, you know, by the single law. These are written by as many as dozens of different staffers. It's unclear actually how many people in Congress have read the whole thing cover to cover. And so we often have ambiguous and complicated and inconsistent phrases.
Let me see what Becky from New Hope has to say. Becky, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I actually benefit from the subsidy myself. But what it seems to me, if I'm understanding the description of this case correctly, that Mr. King is basically going, well, if I can't have a subsidy, nobody else can.
Well, Becky, Ted Ruger is shaking his head no. And this is complicated,
yes.
So I'm not surprised you have a question.
What King and the other challengers are saying is they don't think they should have to be – they don't think the Affordable Care Act is a valid exercise of federal power. They don't think they should be forced by the federal government to insure themselves or insure their workers. So they're going to use any legal means necessary to subvert the act. And they found this phrase that to be fair, to read it in the literal plain language established by the state,
right,
is a real challenge to the act.
Becky, that we can't entirely answer your question, but it's a good one. Let me see what Mark from Bethlehem has to say. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about King's specific argument. Was he saying that he did not make enough money to qualify for the subsidy, and then therefore he shouldn't be forced to buy health care? Or was he eligible, like the previous caller was saying, and he was taking the subsidy but just still didn't like having to be forced to buy health insurance?
Mark, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's two kinds of individuals that would – if you don't like the Affordable Care Act, you might have standing to bring a suit here. One is if you're an individual who – would be subject to the individual mandate. The part of the act that establishes the individual mandate says you have to get health insurance if it is affordable to you. So somebody who makes, say, $30,000 but doesn't want to spend any of his or her income on health insurance could say, well, I shouldn't be – if without the subsidies, I can't afford it.
Right.
So I shouldn't, you know, have to do it. It also – there's – some of the challenges are businesses, because the other thing says – there's a penalty on businesses whose employees there's a penalty on businesses who don't offer health insurance, whose employees then go and have to get it through the exchanges at taxpayer cost through the subsidies. Now, you take away the subsidies, those businesses can deny workers health care and then not be subject to the federal penalties because those workers aren't getting federal tax subsidies.
Wow.
So there's these are the people who may oppose the act, although, you know, overlaying this all is the same ideological opposition that has driven prior lawsuits.
I mean, is there something about government mandates that are considered unconstitutional? Or, I mean, no one wants to pay taxes, we have mandates for so many different things.
Well, we would have – I mean, one would have thought that we asked that question and the Supreme Court answered it in 2012 when they upheld barely the individual mandate. So there is an element of this case, and a lot of the lawyers behind it and are the same ones who drove the prior litigation in 2012, that this is an effort to use whatever means necessary to subvert this statute that they don't like. And – the last time they raised a constitutional challenge, this time it's a technical statutory challenge.
But what's so interesting to me is that the idea of a mandate goes back to the 1990s, goes back to Republicans, goes back to conservatives who said it was about It's about responsibility, which is that if you get sick and you don't have insurance and you have to go to the ER, someone else is going to pay for it. And that idea, at least 20, 25 years ago, seemed like a sort of a reasonable one. And now it seems as it's described as unreasonable.
Mm-hmm. It's really, I mean, and let's remember, it's a mandate to buy a product in private enterprise. As your caller George said, you know, this is not government insurance. Remember, we rejected the so-called public option, which so this is – it is a hybrid public-private thing, which in different times and different political places was thought to be a compromise, but it's certainly not a compromise now.
Yeah. A tweet from Clifford, and we had an earlier one related to this. So what is keeping the United States from simply agreeing to offer one health insurance plan to all Americans? And this goes back to this notion of single payer. I don't think this will ever go away because we have created such a complicated system.
Oh, I think that's right. And to answer Clifford's question, we've got, you know, hundreds of members of Congress who wouldn't vote for that. Not even clear this president, Obama, would vote for that, much less the next one. And then you've got the entire industry of private hospitals, private physicians, private insurance companies that exists who would fight tooth and nail against that. So we're not going to be in a single payer world in any foreseeable future.
Not in our lifetimes, I guess. So as this case gets argued, what are you going to be listening for?
Well, I think I'll be interested.
Or who will you be watching?
Well,
maybe
I mean, it's
too.
So I'll want to, of course, watch. We'll all be listening to Chief Justice Roberts, and I think Justice Kennedy, who was so forceful in the last case, will be very interesting to see what he says. Interestingly, I'll be also listening for Justice Scalia, who's written he's written very eloquently about his philosophy of statutory interpretation, and he's a textualist. But one of the
meaning
he looks at the text of the statute, not the external purpose. However, one point he made is very important here and might cut in the government's favor. He says it's important to read the whole statute, the whole text, not just a few words here and there. And so that there's actually a textualist argument in favor of the government because which goes something like the plaintiffs here are just picking out three little words when – what we ought to do, it's a very long, complex statute, is look at the whole text. We don't even need to look to purpose. So it'll be interesting to see how Scalia interprets his own writings on that subject.
And can you tell from the way that justices, including the Chief Justice, how they question the lawyers, what they're thinking, or do they kind of, you know, have feints and kind of throw people off?
It's, you know, it's an exercise. There are some people who are the great New York Times writer Linda Greenhouse was famous for predicting at a hugely successful rate at oral argument. But,
oh, really?
And she sat in on, you know, thousands of oral arguments. The rest of us are famous. I think a lot of law professors, including myself, famously bad at predicting. So we know it's going to be a close case. We can predict probably that Chief Justice Roberts will cast the key vote. But we'll be waiting until the last week of June 2015 to figure this out.
Yeah. And we can assume that Kagan and other – I mean that they will be on the other side.
I assume
the more sort of liberal justices, as we describe
I assume
them.
Both based in their case on the prior Affordable Care Act case, but also I teach and read lots of statutory interpretation decisions from people like Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, and increasingly now that she's on the court, Kagan and Sotomayor, right. And they are more likely to take a somewhat more holistic interpretation that would look at the text, but also look at the broad principles and purpose behind a statute. And once you fold in those considerations, there's simply no rationale for treating different states differently vis-a-vis the subsidies.
And do you know who's arguing for the government?
Well, it'll be the Solicitor General and some other lawyers. So it'll be both sides clearly are well represented and it'll be well argued.
Well, my thanks to you, Ted Ruger, for coming in and describing this important case for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Deputy Dean, Professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out how to download podcasts of the show, how to find us on satellite radio, and how to dig through our archives and much more. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.